Well, we're on the verge of hearing Maurice Kenney, and if you haven't heard him before, you're in for a treat. Maurice's relationship with River Styx goes back quite a long way. In fact, he was Maurice made his reputation initially as a barnstorming poet, traveling America by Greyhound bus, giving readings all over the country. In fact, one of his books is called Greyhounding This America. And so he was one of our first distributors. He used to carry River Styx's around with him in his two big knapsacks that he carried with his own books and other works he liked. And help lend us legitimacy, if you could believe it, you know, as he went here and there. Maurice is of Mohawk Indian ancestry. He lives in upstate New York, not far from the Mohawk Reservation. He lives in Saranac Lake, New York. And throughout his career has been influential, not just as a poet, but as a performer, as an editor, and as a publisher. He is the author of more than a dozen collections of poetry and a collection of fiction. Among them are North, Poems of Home, Rain and Other Fictions, Between Two Rivers, his selected poems, and most recent publication is another selected works called On Second Thought, a compilation which includes poetry, fiction, and some of his essays. His writing is characterized they've been called lyrical works of tough intelligence and instinctive empathy. Joe Bruschak wrote that. I think that's a very good, concise description of his lyrical works. I make that distinction because he's also excelled in the long poem. In two particular book-length volumes of works, he's explored the history of culture contact between Mohawks and Europeans, one called Black Robe Isaac Jogues, and the other one called Tecontawonte, Molly Brandt, Poems of War. These are very interesting works which relate the events of history through persona poems in the voices of the participants, developing a kind of new form of dramatic monologue. In addition to his own writing, Maurice has played an important role in the careers of many other writers through his generosity as an editor and as a teacher at the University of Oklahoma, as well as Saranac Lake Community College. He lived in New York City for many years in a little apartment in Brooklyn, and he edited a magazine called Contact 2, which was one of the For 17 years, he was the editor of one of the livelier small magazines, one of the first multicultural journals. His reputation, as I mentioned, was first established by his barnstorming tours and his brilliant readings. He's been called one of the most powerful performers of poetry in the century. Many memories flood through me of Maurice here at River Styx. He did publish through Contact 2 Press a posthumous volume of Arthur Brown's work, St. Louis poet who was among the founders of River Styx, and that book is called Mississippi River Poems. And through the dissemination of his work, Maurice has been instrumental in keeping Arthur Brown's work alive. Just in the last few weeks, some of Arthur's poems were published in a book called The Second Set, which is an anthology of poetry relating to jazz. So without anything else out of my mouth, the event I was recalling was Maurice was reading here, I think about 1980, with Simon Ortiz, and Arthur was in the audience and had been running around for several days with Simon hitting the taverns in St. Louis. And it was, Maurice is such a trooper that when Arthur fell off the stool and started snoring on the floor, he paid it no mind and just didn't miss a beat and kept on right on through. And he hasn't missed a beat yet. Arthur didn't know what he was missing, but he returns every January to pay us a visit. So let's open our ears and hearts and welcome back Maurice Kenney.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you all for being here. And there's some other people here from Saranac Lake tonight, too, and I'm awful glad to see some old buddies from Saranac Lake. Two very fine young artists. If anybody's looking for artists, there are two very fine young artists in the room this evening. It seems strange to be here without my good buddy Shirley LaFleur in the audience, but she's out doing a great thing over there in Europe. She's not a coward like me. I'm an intelligent coward. I don't fly because I don't trust the guy that made it, the guy that takes care of it, the guy that pilots it, the guy that navigates it, or the guy up there. I don't trust anybody. My landlady says I'm a suspicious old bastard, and I said, and paranoid as well. So I'm still riding that Greyhound bus, Michael, 29 hours to come here from Saranac Lake. this new book, I have a hard time finding materials in here. It's too new and I haven't gotten used to it yet, but I think I found the poem I want to start the evening with. Rain by Magic. Rain by magic, rain by magic, rain by magic, rain by song, rain by colors, rain by dance, rain by magic, rain by song, rain by colors, rain by dance, by dance, by dance, by dance, by dance. For Brett, he spotted them. Committed a ceremonial dance around them, knelt, leaned, wet his lips, pressed the trigger, and shot. Click. And for a very long time, the black-eyed Susan would gloss on the paper and perhaps never wither into autumn. He had leaned into something precious, something inexplicably complex. Many poems come from dreams. I think probably with most poets I know, many of our poems come from dreams. And this is a dream poem. My dad was always a very strong supporter of whatever artistic venture I wanted to go into. But he always said, you know, have a career. Get your degree in business so you can make money because you're going to starve to death as a poet. And you know what? Mothers and fathers are usually right. I wish I'd gotten a degree in business. I got an English instead. Essence. I am the blood of this grass which feeds maggots that will consume my flesh. I will return to the field, and my blood will feed the red berry ripening under spring. Grass are my eyes, and I view into the years of desolation out of ruin. The blood will spill on rock. Dry winds will sweep its red dust into space. My eyes are crows who laugh in the early of morning, slanting across elm boughs which have no right to grow in mountain soil. Crows are my black wings. Crows are white winter. Their caw is darkness. The darkness is the ebony rose that wilts in the summer hand. The hand is the receptacle of blood. From these fingers, cries of creation stream. Hawk, peach, the pine, trout of old mountain creeks. My mountain is the mystery of all seasons, now thick in snow, cold to noon, pink of falling light, striking bare tamaracks and rusting cedar. Cedar is where my mother sleeps, her bones brittle and cracked by rod and spade. She'll never pick berries again, nor kiss my father's lips. Berries are blood thinning in veins. I will eat grass, gain strength to combat maggots buried in muscles of my thighs. My father will step out from snow, create summer of December. He will replace the grass. Some years ago in a body of water in the mountains called Twin Lakes, an old dugout, some possibly 600 years old, lifted up out of the mud of this body of water. And I, with three other Mohawk men, went to check this dugout out. It really was just an old log that was dug, literally, dug out and burnt and dug out and burned and dug out. And when I touched this marvelous boat, a piece of the wood fell off in my hand, and I carried it with me a long time, and I went back to that small apartment Michael was talking about in Brooklyn, and every time I'd pick it up, it would quiver in the palm of my hand. And I called up my good buddy Rochelle Ratner, who's a poet, and I told her about it. She said, "Oh, put the bloody phone down, start writing the poem." So I wrote a long 16-page single-spaced poem. I'm not going to read it all. I promise you I won't. As much as I want to, I won't. But there is what we call a chant within the poem, and it deals with our mother, Mother Earth. Four men, voice. Winter and starry moves in the ripple in Sally's braid. Ernie clearing his throat, Francis' new gray shoes. The ragged robe tossed about Dan's shoulders, Peter's coyotes. Yes, I see. I understand. I will listen. I will listen. Now, first, may I have a drink of water? My mother is a turtle. My mother is a fish. My mother is a muskrat. My mother is a beaver. My mother is a boat. My mother is a reed. My mother is my mother. And all her parts are me. My mother is a fish, is a fish, is a fish, is a fish, is a fish. My mother is a reed, is a reed. My mother's corn and bean and squash. My mother's sumac and smoke. My mother's honey. My mother's a berry and the bramble. My mother's the sap of the maple. My mother's a boat. My mother's the rapid in the stream. My mother's the wind. My mother's a coot. My mother's a bear. My mother's this house. My mother's a fire. I am my mother is me. My mother is a fish. My mother is a fish. My mother is a fish. 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 My mother's a bone. My mother's yarrow. My mother's hawkweed. My mother's a deer. My mother's a snipe. My mother's a blue heron. My mother's a yellow rose. My mother's a sprig of mint. My mother's a birch. My mother's cedar that sings in the wind. My mother is a cloud. My mother's a star. My mother's a dream. My mother's a grave. My mother's a wolf. My mother's water. My mother is loam. My mother is fire. My mother is wind. My mother is a fish, is a fish, is a fish, is a fish, is a fish. I am my mother, and my mother is me. And this is the story of four men who boarded a boat so many years ago. Fog has covered footsteps, wind drowned voices. Good old buddy friend of mine, I think, is still here in the audience. Carter Rivard, fine poet in his own right and a great teacher here at WashU. I believe it was Carter who published a poem of mine in a magazine some time ago that he guest edited, and he's never heard me read it, and if you'll indulge me, I'd like to read this poem for Carter. I do, as Michael said, a great deal of traveling, and I often go to schools, and particularly on reservations, where I work with the little kids. And the lovely thing is, you don't always get paid, but you get nice gifts from people. And this was Brenda's gift, dancing at Oneida Nation in Wisconsin. She shook, shook, shook. She shook, shook, shook. She shook, shook, shook. She shook, shook, shook. Beans, maybe. Pebbles, possibly. Rattle, rattle, rattle. Rattle, rattle, rattle. Or rice, but probably corn from one metal colander to another. All the time, her feet slowly lifting, 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 lifting. From the wood floor, dropping, dropping down again onto the planks, which pulsed from her dance. She said nothing as she worked, shaking, 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 shaking the bands, rattling, rattling her shoulders to my gaze. I watched her hips move in time, rhythm of green corn swaying on a July morning breeze. Wisconsin was in her hips, Indian in her rattle as dried kernels rolled around the sieved pans. Music of the longhouse volumed the kitchen. Her ceremony near complete, she hunted out a plastic bag and poured the colander's music into it, then wrapped it in a purple cloth and tied the bundle with hide. Only then did she turn and face my eyes, still hearing her music of the rattle, and felt the gentle dance of her hips and moccasined feet as she held out the purple sack to my hands, a bundle of corn ready to pop over the fire. Some years ago, I did a reading at the MLA, the Modern Language Association, and the night before I was to do the reading, the young woman who was going to introduce me said at 1 o'clock in the morning on the Duke Ellington Bridge, and I had a belly full of spaghetti. I won't tell you about the wine I'd also had. She said to me, she looked at me and she said, "Why do you write poetry?" And I said, "Well, I'll tell you tomorrow." And this is what I told her. Sometimes injustice. The day I was born, my father bought me a .22. A year later, my mother traded it for a violin. 10 years later, my big sister traded that for a guitar and gave it to her boyfriend, who sold it. Now you know why I never learned to hunt or learned how to play a musical instrument or became a Wall Street broker. I was reading that in a prison in the Adirondack Mountains one afternoon to a group of inmates. And this one guy sat in the very front row. It was a large audience, and he sat in the front row in the New York Times in front of him. And I couldn't see his face, I couldn't see his body, and he read the New York Times all the way through my reading. And he held it up like, you know, I'm not going to let those words come anywhere near my ears, that kind of attitude. I finished the poem, and he threw it up in the air, and he goes, "That's me! That's me!" It was Ivan. Remember Ivan from Wall Street? Yeah, and he thought I wrote it about him, and he came up, and he thanked me for the poem. I said, "I didn't write about you. I wrote about me." A lot of my work comes from traveling, and it's true, I do have a book called Greyhounding This America, and it was promoted that I wrote all these poems on the Greyhound. Not true. I didn't write a single poem on the Greyhound. If you ever wrote it, you know. You can't even read Danielle Steele or Stephen King, let alone write a poem, right? But a lot of the poems developed because I wrote it. So I take notes or I buy postcards, that kind of thing. And this time I was invited to Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania to do a reading with a series of other poets. Joy Harjo was there, and Geary Hobson and Robert Conley and Anna Lee Walters. And it was a big weekend of conferencing and readings and things like that. I'm staying in this motel just down the street from where Eisenhower had lived, and just down the street from where Lincoln gave his address, and just a few miles from Carlisle Indian School. And I'd already been there, I'd already been at that school, and the vibes in the air were not good. And the woman who brought me there, Paula Olinger, came into my motel room with this box, so tall, so wide. And she said, these were photographs left over from the Smithsonian book of these children, the native children who were here over in the early years. And I thought you'd find them of interest. Well, I started thumbing through them. And I saw one photograph, and I stopped. And she looked at me, and she said, "When are you going to write the poem?" And I said, "I've already begun." Photograph. Carlisle Indian School, 1879-1918. I hear ancient drums in the eyes, see dances on the mouth. Why is this teenage boy stiff in the shutter? Punishment, pain on the cheek, loss in folded hands. Who is this boy, nationless, nondescript in an army uniform, devoid of hair feather, fetish, and paint? Stiff, young sapling, rising from some eastern wood, straight as a Duwamish totem, tall as a southwestern Mesa Pueblo, color so tight it proclaims a hanging. No pemmican or jerky or parched corn in the clenched fist that your mother gave to eat on the road to Pennsylvania, where Delaware once built long houses, made fires, loved in furs, fished rivers, praised the Creator for boundless beauty. Who is this boy, hair cut, tongue cut, whose youthful warrior braids lies heaped on the barber's floor, spine straightened by General Pratt's rules of order? Ancient image, scattered over forested hills, so many leaves from a dying apple tree. Who is this teenage lad with eyes cold in utter fear, mouth vised and shut a prayer and song, whose thin legs tremble within the army trousers, arms quiver in dread of the unexpected, an instructor standing off from the flash of the insensitive camera demanding compliance? There should be a flute to his lips, making songs, music of love. There should be a lance in his grip to take home game. There should be a future on the roll of his cheek. There should be a vision quest in his spirit, a name given for honorable deeds, a drawing of the deed on stretched skins of the winter count calendar. He stands before the photographer, amalgamated in uniform and shaved head. He stands compromised before his teachers, all that is left to him, which is him, beaded moccasins below the cuffs of his pants. But the beadwork so faint in the photo, his great nation cannot be seen. It can be guessed, however, that probably the supply room ran out of army shoes the morning his wagon arrived at the boarding school. Who is this lad? He has no name, no land, no nation. Is he Jim Thorpe, Louis Tawanama? Where was he born? When was he born? Who is his father, his uncle, his siblings? Who is the mother who suckled him at breast? Is this boy entombed in the unmarked grave of the military institute, which won so many wars by bringing so many proud children to their knees? I listen for the drum in your eyes. Wait to see the dance on your mouth. All I hear are your cries. He has no name, only a reflection. His is one of the many spirits which will forever roam this once free and beautiful land before it became America. This photograph, a reminder of this nameless boy. Who is he? My grandfather. Something a little tiny bit less serious. I'm not really known for my humor. I don't have a lot of it, they tell me. But I have made attempts for a touch of humor. This poem developed, again, riding the Greyhound bus out to Seattle. By the way, it's not the capital of coffee. Syracuse, New York is the capital of coffee. They just took a poll about 2 weeks ago, and Syracuse won. I don't know why, but it did win. But I did a reading in a bar where there was a huge room of billiard tables, and all these guys, you know, these big macho guys were all their cue sticks, and they ain't going to read no book and bows around here. Well, I did. And afterwards, I wrote this poem. And I'm not allowed to read it in Seattle when I go back. The Comet. In the bar, a Mohawk sings a drum beat song into beer bottles, coffee mugs, ears. Coins tinkle into a hat. While in the men's room atop the urinal, standing before erotic scribbles and slogans over the rain of piss, a vase of iris and spring pussy willows embarrasses the pisser with surprise and joy. Macho, holding himself with poems drumming in the bowl, cannot compromise with beauty. Song enters, ice tickles spine as he turns, zips up for the next beer. Rain outside hides Mount Rainier, but feeds sky and earth. Confused by beauty in such odd places, he drops his coin amongst the tinkles in the hat. I taught for a number of years out at University of Oklahoma, to my great pleasure and joy, some marvelous years. Some marvelous friends I left there, and I'm delighted that they did my latest book at the university. And one friend of mine, a young Seminole man by the name of Charlie, he gave me a poem, and I stole it. It was what a heard poem. I love heard poems and found poems. Sopke, Seminole soup. It takes lye, more lye, to make it have good taste. Sweet with salt and black pepper. And boil, 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 and boils the more, Charlie told me in Oklahoma City. Which leads me into a sad poem, a tragic poem, about a Native American woman, a young Mi'kmaq woman. Some of you may know of her, Annie Mae Aguash, who was brutally murdered by the American government in 1976, not 1876. Not 1676, 1976. It was thought that Annie knew of all of the movements of AIM, American Indian Movement, and she seemed to refuse to give the FBI all this information they thought she had. She did not have this information. She had been at Wounded Knee in 73 and 74, mainly to take care of the small children, to make sure they were fed and warm, because it was a cold winter, and educated. And that's what she did at the confrontation at Wounded Knee. But in 1976, they found her young body crumpled in a ditch with a bullet hole through her brain. And of course, our government said, oh, she died of exposure. Well, how did she get the bullet in her brain? And to make it even worse, the government cared so little about her body that they cut off her hands. And they shipped her hands to the capital, to Washington, D.C. And to the best of my knowledge, they are still there in a file. The hands of Annie Mae Aguash, 1976. Out of dark Dakota cold and snow, they rise finger by fingertip, inked in blood to print on skulls, indelibly of those who own no heart, drawn from ancient wells of a million veins, blood close to the skin surface, hands cut at the wrist by foreign tricksters, masters of medieval torture who school the world in depravity, masters starved for flesh and broken bones, strive to keep breath in Salem and the axe hot from human pain. 1989, child of old America, girl of fervor, youth of freedom, woman of conscience, Annie Mae, what good are my tears, sorrow, watching the camera move across snow and shadows of your hour, rage, blind sight of what action to take, as I home Oklahoma now temporarily this autumn eve of October in a hall whispering your vision, resounding the language of your voice, students' heads bowed by shame in the horror, too startled by your murder to protest. They have seen Sand Creek, Milai, and now the massacre of you, mind raped and spirit, head crushed after gunshot, hands severed at the wrists from their duty, packaged in sawdust and shipped to the capital for further contamination. 3. All you ever wanted was milk in your breasts, for the children corn and rabbit for the generations, cleanliness of the earth for naked feet to touch while dancing on the belly of their mother, freedom from want. Is that so much to ask? Respect for a grave, respect for a prayer, respect for the first moon and the first sun rising slowly over turtle's back. Rage is not sufficient. For I kiss those severed fingers one by one, hoping to suck out your courage and defiance, your strength as seed to replant, harvest to nourish the very young of the people, all people. Finger by fingertip, I kiss the flesh and suck the blood which spurts from your life. As long as drums bang and songs remain the essence of humankind, I lay this eagle prayer feather on your figurative grave, knowing well rage is not enough, nor revenge satisfactory. 1976 blows your mind, doesn't it? Blows your mind. And it blows my mind every time I think of our children. Our children, particularly in large cities like St. Louis, where they live in ghettos and our government doesn't know they're alive, nor care that they're alive. They have the big parties, their inauguration parties, and they dance and they wear their furs and they drink champagne, and these kids are unloved, unschooled, and prepared for what? Prison or death? And it's always happened with Native children, and I know you're all aware of that. And sometime back in 1979, the New York Times ran a fairly long story on the Inuit children of Alaska and northern Canada. And a poem developed from that article. And I took a quote from the article, a quote of a teenage Inuit child. And the quote is, "I wish I kill myself like hell." And it's in his voice. "I write this on barroom walls. It spells the death of caribou. I forget we are the eaters of raw meat. The northern moon freezes on my cheek. There must be some bird to imitate. I forget the words of the morning songs. I will put my ear to the ice. It remembers." Sad, isn't it? This culture is gone. This culture is gone. It's in the ice. It's in the ice. And if I can find it, I not always can, kind of a humorous poem. "Greyhounding to Billings, Montana. Hey, you Indian." I nodded. "Hey, you Indian." His cowboy hat fell onto the beer can in his lap as he turned to his Sikh companion reading a Superman comic. "I rode from Chicago to Minneapolis with these two dudes. I thought they were greasers." He topped his head again with the hat and sipped his beer. "They were real live up. Apaches!" I stood waiting to get into the bus bathroom. "Eh! I asked if you was Indian, Mohawk. From back east there?" He sipped
his beer again. Man, it's good sitting next to a normal person, and he slouched in the seat. I agreed and closed the bathroom door and turned on the bright light. 2 weeks later, passing through Billings, he was still there in the bus station. He'd been thrown off. It's a strange thing. Does anybody ever walk over to you and say, are you a human being? You know, you have hair. Are you a woman? You don't have any hair. Are you a man? Well, I was, you know, coming out here in the Greyhound bus and standing in Albany, New York. This guy came over to me and he said, are you Indian? And I said, yeah. He's going, hey, everybody, this guy's an Indian. Look at him. Look at him. He's an Indian. Do people in America do that to other people? I hope not. Do they? Dumb, right? Dumb, real dumb. You know what? Another poem is going to come out of that. Another poem is going to come out of that, that's for sure. I waited till last to read, with your permission, of course, some poems from Tekon Wadonte, Molly Brandt. I lived with this woman for 12 years, even though she was born in 1735. And I wasn't. I don't think I was. Maybe, but I don't think so. And she died in 1795 in Kingston, Ontario, Canada. She was the legitimate sister of Joseph Brandt, the young lad who was running around the American Revolution and, you know, burning villages down for the British. He thought the British should win. And sometimes I wish they had. Sometimes I wish they hadn't, but sometimes I wish they had. And Molly herself was also running around as a leader of a group of warriors, male warriors. She was a warrior. She had met and married at the age of 15 a gentleman by the name of William Johnson. Any historians in the audience? William Johnson fought the battle at Lake George and Niagara and Montreal, Quebec. And because of him, he pushed the French back into Canada. And because of him, we speak English in this country instead of French. Well, the British knighted him for that act. And he met this absolutely beautiful and intelligent young woman, the age of 15, by the name of Tekon Wadonte. She who is outnumbered, her name means she who is outnumbered. And they fell madly in love, even though he was 35 and she was somewhere around 15. He liked young girls. She was his third wife. Both of the other two wives were 15. His second wife was a German girl by the name of Katharina Weissenberg, and he bought her for $15, an indentured servant. And she lived in his house for 10 years, and she gave him one son and one daughter. And the night she died at the age of 25, he found a piece of copper someplace out in the barn, and he put it on her finger and legally married her because he wanted this one son, John, to carry on the baronetcy, okay? Well, at the same time, of course, he was living with Molly Brandt, Tekon Wadonte. They lived together for 21 years, and she gave him 8 children of hers. I'd like to read a couple of poems from the book, a couple in William's voice and a couple in Molly's voice. He died in 1774, and a number of historians suggest that perhaps he was assassinated. He was a very powerful man in the colonies, and there was some fear that he would go with the British should the colonies strike out against the crown. And this is on his deathbed. He is dying, and this is in his voice on his deathbed. Sir William Johnson. Catty? Catty? Who? My wife? My wife is Molly Brown Mary. Oh, yes, the servant girl I bought those years back, the German from the flats, indentured. Yes, yes, she bedded in my bed, suckled my son, and hid in the closet when gentlemen and ladies came to sup or tea. Not very bright, as I remember. Yes, I did take her to Mary, her 25th birthday. That long night she died. She kept a clean house and snot from her child's chin. I dignified her bed and breast. I placed a copper ring upon her finger and took shame from her cheek. Least I could do. Poor Catherine. Poor Catherine. Bury the remains of my beloved wife, Catty, next those of mine. My hair streams in the river. Chips of my flesh shrivel under the sun. The nub of my little finger is buried in the earth with his bones. I have no arms to protect me, no cheek against my own, no might to protect my house or the limbs of my children. Who will hunt for my pot? Times I spread my legs and gave him his flesh. 21 years we lay thigh by thigh under summer stars. How do I pull grass over his face now? The war was over. However, it left its marks on Molly. As I think I said earlier, that she was a very beautiful woman. In fact, there were those of her time that thought she was perhaps the most beautiful woman in the colonies at her time. And there were those who did not like Indian people very much back in those days. And particularly George Washington, people like George Washington and General Amherst and those guys. And, of course, Washington was called town burner by the Iroquois people because he would go in and burn their towns down and all of their winter supplies, their corn that was put away or whatever had been put away. So he was called town burner. And we know that they tried desperately hard to get rid of the Iroquois first with religion, and that didn't work because people like Tekakwitha, Lily of the Mohawks, embraced religion. She became the first Indian nun and may become the first Indian Native American saint, right? She's been beatituted. Is that the word, beatituted? You're a teacher. Beatituted, is that the word? Something like that. Canonized. Thank you. And then it was liquor, and liquor didn't do it. Hey, we're still standing here. However, I'm not at the bar. And then the next thing they discovered would be illnesses, diseases, and particularly smallpox. Oh, boy, did that do the job. And unfortunately, somebody gave these blankets soaked in the in the syrups. The smallpox, and Molly touched one. Molly's likeness, smallpox. Artists have been here at the hall. Paint from their pots has spilled and dotted the parlor rugs. They painted William ever so handsome.
My brother Joseph truly shining in his finest attire. Red plumes, red cloak, his sturdy neck tied with a ribbon holding the white shell. I asked them to paint Juba. They smirked and looked toward my gelding in preference. He is powerful in beauty, but Black Juba is powerful in beauty too. They asked for my pose. I was flattered that they would have this Indian woman sit for their brush. One painter wanted me in silk and crinoline. Oh no, Lady Mary Brown, sit here on this stone in the sunshine, the woods and the river behind in your war bonnet. War bonnet, I question. True, I have ridden to war, but I wore no feathers. Ridiculous. Juba brought my fan, my comb and mirror. She brought beads, an assortment of jewelry and paints. I held up the mirror and instantly knew I could not sit. I could never look at the reflection. I did not wish my great-grandchildren to see my face. But Lady Mary Brown, dear Molly, we can erase those scars, one painter exclaimed. But could he, truly? Could he really erase my scars and the scars that cling still to the lodges of Kanajahari? Replace living flesh on empty beds, beds covered with blankets soaked in the liquids of death? It wasn't just my face. Scars on my cheek, holes on my brow. It was the terror, horror, pain, and the death of all the others. No, not today, I said, graciously, appreciatively. No, do not paint today. Perhaps tomorrow you'll decide to paint Juba instead. And that, my friend, is the reason you have no portrait of me. Juba and I have spent half the morning cleaning paint from the rugs, scrubbing with husky brushes and stringent waters. The war is over. She is living on Carleton Island in the St. Lawrence River. She demands the British build her a house of rock, not the church, but a really house of rock for her nation, for her people to survive. The government of the United States decides that Carleton Island belongs to the United States, and so she has to move, and she moves to Kingston, Ontario, Canada, where she 1795, and this is in her voice as well. As a deer warms my belly, we warm the earth, it is natural. As I would suck the marrow of a bone, the earth has the right to mine. Even this river one day must dry, become the sun, the clouds again. This I know. I've seen the thistle bloom to beautify summer wither. I've seen the flowers of the snow melt flake by flake. The flesh and hide and fur of possum disintegrate on the forest floor, and watched the following spring a trillium rise in its place. And that should be. And yet I mourn. I mourn the thistle, river, deer, my own flesh and yours, as we wither in the winter, as we take our place in death, in earth, and become spring's new green corn, autumn's apple, the calf my grandson shall one day feast upon, the sun's cycle, the wind's return, the weeds and berries of the fields, pine needles on the mountain slope, the trickle of the spring drop of the rain. This I know. It is natural, And as it should be, the shell become the sand, the sea. I'm going to read just two poems more. This one poem from the book, Tekon Wodonte Mali Brandt, is in the voice of Chief Pontiac, not the car, not the automobile. This was a real live living man. He was an Ottawa chief. And Francis Parkman said he conspired to fight the British Army. He did not conspire to fight the British Army. He made loud noises about it. I don't want you. You're coming into my country, and I'm going to stop you. And he gathered as huge a force of Native warriors as he possibly could. Well, he lost. And later he was assassinated. And this is in his voice from the spirit world, Pontiac. My footprint is still there. On fallen leaves and cleared ground. My scent is still upon the river where I bathed each morning. My words are on the wind echoing through pine. My blood is in the loins of my sons and daughters. My flesh is there. It is the earth. You walk on it. You take harvest from it, the corn you eat, the tomato you plant, the cottonwood that shades, the deer skin that warms your flesh. I wrap you, I sing you, I blood you. I'm stronger now than ever before. I am many, my war cry is loud. You hear it, I am many. I am the broth of your soup. I am the hawk and the elm. I am the leather of your boot. I sing you. I blood you. Tell this to the historian who chronicles. Tell this to the general who believes me dead. I sing you. I blood you. I am the bone of your thought. And the last poem I'll read tonight, I think, is somewhat lighter. And if I can find it here, I think it's here. It should be here. It's supposed to be here. Sometimes it's hard to find, though. I know it's here. It's got to be here. It's here. I know it's here. I had it all marked out. Friendship Days at Akwesasne. Akwesasne is the Mohawk Reservation, sometimes known as St. Regis, on the St. Lawrence River, and it's split by the border of Canada and the United States. And in June every year, the people kind of organize a coming home time or a family reunion time for a weekend, and I like to go up for that weekend. Friendship Days at Akwesasne. Humid afternoon by the St. Lawrence. Women canoe racers paddle the river, full of fry bread, soda, and hot strawberry rhubarb pie. I stumble under the cedar arbor to listen to the drum and singing. Outfitted Mohawk circle a stomp dance. I take a place on a bench near an elder woman who asks in Mohawk, "What do I do?" Tote bag slung over my left shoulder, I figure I should own up. I'm a writer. And smiles. What kind, she asked, really curious. A poet, I replied proudly, to which she offered a grunt, got up from the bench, and huffed off. Well, maybe she was right. Thank you.